my adage is, once I'm on set, if it moves, time it.
Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11% podcast. We explore roles and opportunities within the creative industries with the aim of improving diversity, in addition to promoting, providing a platform, and shouting about awesome women and those identifying as non-binary. For episode 82, we are joined by film and television royalty script supervisor Emma Thomas. I discovered only last week the responsibilities in full of what it is a script supervisor does. A bloody hell of a lot. And Emma has been doing it for over three decades, working on in excess of 50 productions. Her contribution to the industry has not gone unnoticed. And in 2019, she received a BAFTA Craft Award for her talents and hard graft. Emma's career started out as a clerk typist at Elstree Studio, where she was responsible for answering the fan mail of her boss, Kermit the Frog. In all the people I've interviewed for this podcast, I do believe this has to be the best route into the creative industries I've had to date. Moving on from responding to adoring fans of the Frog, Emma began typing transcripts for the Muppets and then transitioned to the offices of children's TV classic Tiswas. It was here where she landed on what she wanted to do and relentlessly pursued a training course in script supervision, which was a huge challenge at the time, as places were as rare as hen's teeth. I feel like Emma has her hand in many things I've seen on the small and big screen. So to name but only a few, TV series such as Birds of a Feather, The Bill, Teachers, Bad Education, Luther, Soon Gone, A Windrush Chronicle, and in films, The Boat That Rocked, Boy A, Farming, and Adam Smet Hearst's The Twelfth Night. Emma is passionate about supporting emerging talent. She mentors. She is a board member of Women in Film and TV and regularly hosts information sessions in connection with the Script Supervisors Association and the Guild of British Camera Technicians. Emma, I'm so fascinated by your role because, as I mentioned, I was completely oblivious to about 50% of your responsibilities up until last week. So I'm looking forward to lifting the lid on all you do and also discussing your stellar career. Welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Hello, Renee, and thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, I am so excited to talk to you because, as I mentioned a couple of times in the intro, I mean, your role is unbelievable when you broke it down last week when we caught up. So to kick off, can we dive in with you walking us through what it is a script supervisor does?
For the purposes of this interview, I could be here all day. I'm going to give you the short version for your audience. I'm going to talk about drama in particular. Once I get the phone call, it's really broken down into pre-production, in-production, and post-production. What a script supervisor does really in the drama section, each department, makeup, costume, lighting, art department, all the departments that all join together, they all sort of do their own breakdowns for the scripts, both in film and for TV. Mm-hmm. So basically what happens that on the first day of principal photography, the script supervisor is responsible for the continuity, regardless of what the script says. So though we've all prepared everything, right up until day one, you get those creative juices and then things start to change. So that then becomes the script supervisor's job to make sure the jigsaw puzzle will fit, i.e. in the editing suite. That's the short version.
Basically, you have to make sure that everything looks the same between each take all the time.
Well, as much as possible, because as we all know, if you've got a nervous actor, their continuity is going to go out the window. But by the same token, if you've got, you know, a very professional actor, it'll always be about the performance. It's sort of a case of what can you get away with without disturbing the performance, but still maintain that it's the take that the director wants to use. And also, when they get into the edit suite at the end of the production, they're recreating the next phase of that production. So you do the best you can on the set at the time. Mm-hmm. But it will always come down to the actor's performance, because we've all seen continuity mistakes on TV, absolutely everybody, and then people wonder how they've managed to get away with it or not.
I have to admit, I love spotting when things aren't consistent. I really love it, and it's not even a judgment thing. It's just like, you know, that obviously there's some way that they just couldn't make it happen, but it also keeps you on your toes. But obviously that probably doesn't make you very happy when you're doing your job.
Well, you know what, at the end of the day, it'll always be about the story. So if there's a continuity mistake in it, but the story is absolutely amazing, chances are not many people will see it. If it's a really boring film, boring TV show, that's when people start to spot different mistakes. Six script supervisors could go and see a film and we'll all see something different, and none of us worked on that particular film.
So it's almost like you've got another sense now, I guess, and your muscle around this, seeing you've been in this role for a fair amount of time, must be like Hawkeye's.
It's really getting to know the director. So that's why it's great if you keep working with the same group of people. I think you'll find that there's quite a few, you know, very famous directors literally had their same team and go round with them all the time, because it just, you know, it's a shortcut. But I still like working with up and coming directors as well as the, you know, the old school directors. So once you get to know them and you've got their confidence, then you can do the best possible job that you can do at the time. And then you've also got the actor's trust.
It's such an exciting role as well, because you like cross over multiple departments. So you must get a really good sense of the whole production as well.
Yeah, well, that's sort of one of the reasons for doing the job, because, you know, it's not just one area. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to sort of pick up, you know, there's some sound in the background that went over a particular line. You know, you're going to be looking straight at the sound recorder. So it's going to make a sign to you as well to make sure that that's been noted. Because if that's the take the director wants, then the sound recorder will have to put a note in his or her information as well when that goes to the editor.
Amazing. Okay, so I mentioned a little bit about your early career, and you've been in this role for like 30 odd years. So winding back a smidge, I'd love to hear it from you, kind of your pathway to where you are now.
Oh, okay. So my sister was going to drama school. She was having more fun. I was going to secretarial college. So I just thought, well, I don't really want to be an actor, even though it sounded like she was having fun. But I did support her when she was doing shows appearing in theatre, et cetera, et cetera. Ironically, when I decided I wanted to find a job within the TV industry, she actually wasn't in that particular show. But I did end up going to quite a few studio shows.
So you were focusing on secretarial school. You left that and you got your foot in the industry. And is that when you started working, as I politely put it, for Kermit the Frog?
No, actually, the way my parents brought us up was that, you know, further education, there's no option. You're definitely doing it. Just decide what you're doing. Yeah. So I went to secretarial college. I got my first job working for an accountant that was based at ATV. So I'm sure there won't be many people that remember that particular company. And it was owned by Lord Grade, one of the Grade forefronts, really, of the theatre industry. Anyway, so I ended up getting there because everybody kept saying to me, get a foot in the door. So I ended up working for an accountant and nothing to do with TV. I had a lovely boss, though, because he knew I wanted to get my foot in the door somewhere, somehow. So he was very supportive. But I did stay there for about 18 months. And so the way that I ended up getting at least applying for the training was that, as you say, the training scheme was like gold dust. So when I applied the very first time, I didn't get it, but the woman in the Muppet office did. So they were very good. So I got shortlisted. So basically they said to me, you didn't get the training this time. It's gone to, and I can't remember her name, but what we'd like you to do, would you like to come over to Elstree and work in the Muppet office? So I think the words were, yes, when can I start? And unfortunately, there was an overall TV strike at that time. So I actually didn't get into the Muppet office until nearly 9 months later.
Oh, wow.
Then I stayed, I stayed with them. It was absolutely fantastic, answering the fan mail for Kermit the Frog and the rest of the puppets. Met lots of American stars as well. So I was, you know, died and gone to heaven, basically. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah. So the Muppets then were going into doing a lot more films and less TV. And I was still staff at Central TV. So when the opportunity came to work on Tiz Was, as Chris Tarrant and Lenny Henry and all that team were one of my favourites, that was the next thing. And so I was young, free and single. You basically pack your bag and you go. So that's when I went to Birmingham. So whilst I was in Birmingham, I still kept applying, kept notifying everybody that I definitely want to try and get on this training scheme because I knew it was like gold dust. And eventually I did get it, but I had to move to Nottingham. And that's where I did my training.
Wow. So like total persistence in making sure it happened.
Yes, because once you've got that training, you know, nobody can take it away from you. And it's a recognised system. That's the best bit.
Yeah. What was the training like? What was it focused on?
Well, you got to do a bit of everything with lots of different, well, they were called production assistants in those days. So the job now is called script supervisor, but it is the same job. You spent your time doing live news programs, live music shows. That's certainly good for the nervousness, should we say. You end up doing drama, which I ended up specializing in. You did certain game shows, which I didn't particularly like, but you still do it as part of your training. Then you go out to do filming, which they called outside broadcasts. So there's outside broadcasts within a sports environment, and then there's outside broadcasts within a sort of drama environment. Quite a bit different. One, you spent a lot more time in the truck, should we say, where all the team are. But if it was a drama, you were out there standing on the set in all the elements. So you did a couple of music shows, gallery, multi-camera shoots, absolutely everything. So that by the end of the 9 months, you could literally do anything that the company asked you to do within their remit. And at the time, that was Central TV. So they did a bit of everything.
Is the course very similar for script supervision now? Does it follow the same kind of structure?
The only other course that would be that long would be the BBC, and I don't think they're doing that anymore either. So training, unfortunately, for anybody that wants to be a script supervisor, there isn't that long-term training available anymore. The closest you might get, and I don't know how much it is the Avril Rowlands course. So you could spend a week with her.
Wow, what a difference compared to the kind of training that you went through.
Yes, absolutely, which is why it's more important that I can pass on as much of my knowledge, because I was lucky enough to get that valuable training.
So going back to the role, and again, like I learned last week when we caught up, that the role is actually situated in the camera department. So you've kind of mentioned as well that you've got a toe in lots of different departments, and you're pretty much the glue, I feel, like tying pre-production to production to post-production. I was really fascinated with the work that you do in pre-production, which I didn't have any understanding of. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, that when you get the script, before any kind of thing happens, what is it that you do?
Yeah, once I've had the phone call, found out a bit more about the director, found out if her or his CV is shorter or longer than mine, so I know how to approach them. Well, it makes a difference if you're working with a, you know, a younger director. yes, but you know, you sort of need the variety of different experiences from all the different directors, because they're all bringing in, you know, a different element to each project, which makes it more interesting. So yeah, so depending on whether it's one long feature film, which will probably range between 90 minutes and 2.5 hours, the finished product obviously will be 90 minutes or thereabouts, or a six-parter, either 6 1-hours or 6 30-minutes, like a comedy show. Just depends which of the particular jobs I've accepted. So for the purpose of this explanation, I'll be working on a comedy show and there's 6 episodes, which I've read through and timed scene by scene. And this will just be literally an estimate. That's all I can say. The good thing is that there's been a series before, so I was able to watch that one first. and get a little insight into, you know, the pace of the program. But if you're working on a feature film, you won't have that luxury.
When you say time, what do you mean? So you're reading the script. How do you time it?
This is what I do. All the script supervisors, we all do something slightly different. So I'll just have the script in front of me and I'll probably be walking around my living room playing all the parts and reading it out loud. There's quite a bit of difference in just reading it to yourself and actually reading it out quite loud. So that would give my, that would give me estimates. And I have to allow for if there's an action piece in there, if there's a scene that says they make love. So we've always got to put an estimate in there. But given the current climate, I'm not sure we're going to have many of those scenes. So alternatively, we could have the army marches over the hill, socially distanced, obviously. So you've then got to find out, is it the beginning? Is it the end? You know, are they in battle? Are they just starting? And you just give it, your very first timing is just an estimate. And then you'll ask more questions later.
Wow, that's so detailed as well. And you also have to use your, obviously, experience, but also your imagination. Because obviously, a style and directors are all different. So the way that they may want something, you know, timing may be impacted by that.
You'd like to think that the writer has already built that into the script. So you can, you know, you get quite a good idea. The first time you're reading it, sometimes you're literally just sitting there reading it, not timing it. I tend to do that for feature films so that I can just get absorbed into the film totally. Not so much for TV, because I think that is quite a quick turnaround. But certainly for film, you just need to get the story. And if the writer's done an amazing job, it's an absolute page turner.
Yeah, that must be exciting. So you've broken down the script, you've timed it all out. You then have a conversation with the director so that you've kind of worked out, I guess, what you need in terms of duration to capture those scenes. Is that correct from your timing?
You're probably sending it over to the production office, first of all, so that they can notify the director, the writer, the line producer, producers, et cetera, et cetera. So to make sure that it's within the broadcaster's remit. Obviously, the broadcaster gives you, this is the slot, but the script can be much longer. What we don't want is for the script to be much shorter. Otherwise, you know, the writer's got a problem. If it's too long, then the first AD will have a problem trying to fit all the scenes into the required shooting schedule. So there's a lot of reasons why they're asking for timings earlier on. Again, it's still only a guesstimate, but it gives them a good idea.
Yeah. And when you say first AD, you mean the assistant director?
First assistant director, correct.
So that happens in pre-production. We know in production that you are the eyes, ears and everything that's like making sure that there's consistency across. And then what happens in post-production?
Ironically, you do begin with the end in mind. We sort of skipped a step though, because we need the pre-production and we need to go into production. Yeah. So everything that you've prepared, the script breakdown, which lists near enough every single prop, every single costume change, if they're flashbacks, et cetera, that's your continuity Bible. And all these things you actually end up sending to the editor so that they're prepared with estimated timings and the continuity Bible. So they've got a breakdown of the story as well before they even start receiving the visual images.
Now, again, that's another part that I didn't realize. So they're kind of forewarned almost, and then they're just marrying up what's coming in, because obviously things may change from that to production. Do you keep updating that as production is underway?
Yes, whilst we're in production, those are the forms that we're sending in to them so that they, on a daily basis, they'll know the update. So if a scene has been cut, they obviously need to know that fairly swiftly. And so it fits into the storyline. But hopefully we can just keep, we're on a sort of, you know, a daily conversation, or at least an email conversation. And in the current climate, a Zoom conversation. So, yeah, so, you know, it's a constant flow, really. They would have had several different conversations with the director as well on a daily basis, and the producers. What I like to do after, say, 3 or 4 days into the shoot is sort of send an email to the editor just to find out if they've made an assembly edit of any of the larger scenes, any of the bigger scenes, and whether, you know, I'm underrunning, overrunning, or mm-hmm. we haven't got enough material, etc., etc., etc. So as I say, it's a constant email conversation.
What's just really struck me about your role is that you have to be so focused and detail orientated, but you also have to be really lateral in your thinking and thinking back and forward at the same time. So your brain must be like on high alert at all times.
We all go into the shoot mode. It's not just my department, it's all the departments. We're all going to shoot mode. But that's sort of why you're in it. But we're all supporting each other.
Mm.
If I've got a really good art department, props, standby props, it's teamwork, makeup, costume, everybody, we're all supporting each other.
I mean, that's what I love about being on shoots, is that you actually feel like, everyone's working towards one goal. There's something really, energizing about that.
Yes.
All right. So talk to me about the value of a stopwatch in connection to your job.
My adage is, once I'm on set, if it moves, time it. Because if you sometimes see the actors, in the corner just running their lines, one of our jobs is to offer to go and read the other line if the other person hasn't come on set. And also, it's just good to see whether your timings are anywhere near what we think the performance is going to be. And as we all know, when the creative juices start, once the camera's rolling, it can be very, very different. It's sending all that information and the timings and the overall estimated running time of that project is sent on a daily basis. So if we're running under and there's not enough material, then, we'll be having a word with the editor. If there's too much material and we've still not covered bits and pieces, we're having a word. Everybody's involved in the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's the value of the stopwatch. Pre-COVID days, if you were doing an intimate scene, you also want that stopwatch not to be beeping. So the industry standard is Seiko Sound Producer stopwatch, which is absolutely amazing. You can literally click it and nobody will hear it. So that's a little insight into the type of stopwatch that I've been using and quite a few people had.
I like that. It feels very James Bond, which is a great connection, obviously, with you working in the film industry. But the other element of that is, how do you shift out of that? So if you're timing, say you were on a production 6 weeks, 3 months, whatever it is, and you're timing everything all the time, do you then, when you step away from that in your downtime, be like timing things?
It's easy to switch off.
Okay, I'm getting on the bus. It's taking 10 seconds. I'm sitting, I can see the way my mind would work. So the role doesn't seem to get much downtime. You don't seem to be able to clock off when everyone else on the production or most people on the production do. So what's your tricks for managing your time and staying focused? Because obviously on a longer production, your energy levels to keep that up must be quite tiring.
They are. You've got to sort of prepare for that, really. So possibly not go to the rave the night before, and possibly not go to the rave during the week. You just do what you need to do, depending on what the shoot day is going to be. If it's going to be, say, okay, so it's a court drama, so you're not going to be running around much because you're going to be sitting in a courtroom for most of the day. So again, you've got to manage your energy for that. But if you are shooting those action sequences with the armies marching over the hill, you just got to make sure that you've got all the right equipment, hopefully, for all weathers. And those would be sort of one of the challenges. So you just want as much information as possible. I've always got a spare sort of rain cover in my bag anyway, and a cap and all the bits and pieces.
I guess I was thinking as well, I know that as a script supervisor, you work 13, 14 hour days. And if you're doing that consistently for 3 months, then how do you not, when you get up in the morning, just be like, oh, am I going to make it through today?
Yeah, depending on the project, we want to try and get an assistant. So if we are using more than two cameras a day, then you definitely need an assistant. With the best will in the world, it's impossible to be watching three, four cameras running all at the same time. So you do need another pair of eyes. If this wasn't planned at the beginning, when you're sorting out your deal, then you've got to keep it production informed. if they've got to do a second unit, you know, to shoot some pickups and bits and pieces, which does happen quite a bit on feature films, less so on TV, unless it's a long-running mini-series.
Yeah, I guess it's like you're saying, not going to the raves and, yeah, trying to get early nights when you can. I mean, I love that. I imagine you in your downtime now. Am I going to raves?
I had lots of things planned before COVID, you know, for concerts and catching up, et cetera, et cetera. But, we, you know, funny enough, we've all really rested, which has been quite nice. And I think that's why a lot of us sort of want to get back into the, get back on the horse, really, and get back on set. Because we've all had that extra bit of time now to really, you know, recharge our batteries.
How important is personality and a good sense of humour for the job? Because you intimately work with the director and, you know, I'm curious if there isn't a bond or respect in terms of the working relationship, then I'm sure that must make it tough. So how do you manage maybe the more demanding directors?
Well, the first thing you're thinking, how long is this going to last? It is about personalities and you just do the best thing that you can. You're not working in a permanent job. So really, if it's that bad, you know, it has to be a last resort. And you have to have a good reason for walking off. But you would have found out as much as you can before you start the job. And i.e., you're talking to as many people that have worked with that director before. And you're doing the same for other people without, you know, it's like you're not bad mouthing them by any sense, but you can just say, look, okay, this director likes you to be on your game and by their side all the time. Brilliant. So you're absolutely prepared for that. Mm. Or you're working with somebody that doesn't always want to be crowded round by a script supervisor or any members of the crew, wants to sit by the monitor by themselves, and then you'll just find your place but have some sort of communication. But if you haven't established that in the interview, when you're chatting to them, because I find really I'm interviewing the director these days. So if I think it's not going to work out, I'm going to find an excuse to not be available. Mm. We may have to cut that bit out. If George Clooney's listening, I didn't mean you. I think it's the joys of being freelance. It's never going to last for too long. So, you know, we can always make it work.
Which I think goes back to having a good sense of humour. And I mean, that your outlook just is really focused on the job. And, you know, I think it's sometimes maybe hard when you have got a very demanding boss, even in a freelance capacity. But it sounds like you have managed to wrangle that.
You just do the job with the best resources and the time possible. And then you walk away, say, thank you very much. And then the next time you get a phone call, you might not be available, shall we say.
Speaking of celebrity and industry gossip, I am curious to know, because I'm a bit nosy, what has been your favourite production to work on and why?
Well, you know, they've all been my favourite. I know it sounds really weird because there's good and bad things in all the jobs, but they all have. I can't even pick one. You know what? It'll probably be The Muppets when I first started just because it was so unusual and my parents thought, what, you're going to work for a puppet, you know, you're going to work on a puppet show, you know, we've just come over from Sierra Leone to make sure you get a good education and one of your major jobs is working for, you know, a team of puppets, until they found out it was Jim Henson's Muppet Show. But you know, those sort of things, really. Yeah. You just keep going.
I love that you've worked on more than 50 productions in your career, and you've said that they're all equally your favourite, with the Muppets maybe coming out a little bit on top.
I think so, because I was still green, for want of a better word, and still starstruck. I probably still am, really. But, you know, each job, it helps if it's a fantastic location. Pre-COVID days, you know, if it's an amazing location in the Caribbean, South Africa, Italy, whatever, you know, that makes it possibly more favourite than the one that you were sitting in the cold depths of Bognor, shall we say? But, you know, the job's the job.
You may have just answered my next question. What's the toughest production you've been on and why?
It's Bognor, and you know what? It's to do with the elements, the weather, whether you're in tight spaces, and just trying to maintain concentration. I would much rather be too hot than too cold. Mm. And my concentration does go. So let's just say I'm not accepting any jobs in Iceland because for those sort of reasons. Yeah, it really is to do with the weather. But if you're in a nice location, it makes a lot of difference.
Yeah, I'm with you on the heat. I'm useless in the cold, so, and I love it when it's really hot. I'm energized.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully those Caribbean offers are coming back in the near future, sometime next year maybe.
Yes, I hope so.
So who's a director you would love to work with again? And I'm sure you're going to say all of them, but maybe one or two?
It will probably be Adewale, and he was the director on Farming. Mm-hmm. Just because his story was so personal. And I remember going for the interview. I'd never worked with him before. We'd never met before. But I was in there for like an hour and a half. So we were having a conversation. So I hadn't realised I'd already got the job by then. And we just sort of clicked, really, because it was a very personal story. Mm. It'll be a yes if he's phoning me again sort of thing, depending on what the project is. And that's a lot to do with it. So it could be your favourite director, but the subject matter is not something that you want to do. Mm. So George Clooney is doing the history of Trump. Possibly, no. As much as I think I'd love to work with George Clooney and it's all about Trump, no, I'm not going to do it. Does that sort of answer the question?
Yes.
There are a lot of factors, really. And I suppose as I'm getting older, the subject matter makes a lot of difference regardless of who's directing it.
You are an advocate for teaching and training and mentorship. And we talked about earlier about there's very little formal training now in relation to your role. So can you talk about what you do and how this came about and why it's important to you?
Well, it's important because if nobody trained me, I wouldn't be doing the job I'm doing today. So it's up to me to sort of pass on my skills where possible and where feasible. You have to be a certain type of personality to have somebody that you want to try and teach at the same time. I personally enjoy it, but again, it depends on the project and the people that you're working for. And the other reason was that in my downtime when I was first freelance, I joined Women in Film and TV. And they were absolutely fantastic about just encouraging not just women, but everybody that you meet. You know, trying to pass on information, notify them about any jobs, any training schemes, you know, festivals, et cetera, et cetera. So really, they've been one of the main advocates that have helped me. In fact, when they'd asked me to do my first sort of public speaking engagement, I had to go and train with Toastmasters first. But if I wasn't encouraged by my colleagues at Women in Film and TV, I wouldn't have attempted it at all. So, you know, you just want to pass on as much as you can.
And it's so important, I think, to be part of those networks because it is about having a group of people around you that can support you in different ways. I find them invaluable. And I think Women in Film and TV are amazing in terms of an organisation.
Yes. And also BAFTA now, they're doing more and more training schemes. When you can fit it in around the downtime, you know, it's the best thing you can do. That's one of the reasons why I've said yes to you, Renee. I mean, my downtime, if you'd asked me for next week, it would be no.
Well, I'm glad I've nabbed you just in time. Well, it's a lovely segue because I watched your BAFTA speech online when you got your BAFTA Craft Award last year. So congratulations on that. And you gave a massive shout out to recognition of women behind the screen. And you also stated in the past 5 years, you've worked with more female directors than you have in your whole career. And so whilst there's a long way to go about bringing diversity in front and behind the screen or the camera, what are your reflections as to why we're finally seeing a shift in the industry?
It's an excellent question. It's really that we've had to prove ourselves. And it's been wonderful that I now can walk on a set and not be surprised to see a female lighting gaffer. There's still not very many. But, you know, there are. And that's one of those areas that was like, possibly not, because they've got to lift heavy equipment, all that sort of stuff. Also in the camera department, you know, at least now there are always trainees in the camera department on whatever production you are. Many, many years ago, more men than women. Now it's across the board, which is fantastic. Yeah, so there's more female directors now than I've worked with in my whole career. And that's mainly because they now are getting chosen for the high-end dramas. Because I've chosen to specialise in drama, I'm now getting to work with more of them. Had I worked, say, in children's department, which is sort of traditionally female, which it shouldn't be, it might be a different story today.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how women got pigeonholed in the children's department. And, you know, we are seeing a massive change, and we're seeing it everywhere, like in terms of on TV, in film, within media. And I just wonder if you've got any thoughts in terms of how we can speed up the process, which is like a big question, I know. But I'm really, you know, and that's what Greater Than 1% is about, is how do we start that momentum, like really start accelerating it?
Yes, I was going to say, I think we need to sort of join up the resources, especially now. Because if there's several different mentoring schemes, there's only going to be so much money available and resources available and people's time available. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, a big shout out for Women in Film and TV. Their mentoring scheme is second to none because it's sort of slightly outside the box. I just feel, and then with Screen Skills, they're doing a wonderful job. BAFTA are doing a wonderful job. So I think if anybody else is trying to set up like another type of mentoring scheme, the resources are drying up, especially now.
Yeah, that's actually a really poignant point, actually, is thinking about how bringing everything together. Also, it just makes it a stronger net, doesn't it, as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So going back to the role, what skills are needed to be a script supervisor?
Sense of humour. an actual genuine interest in the film and TV business, because you're going to be watching a lot of different films and TV and still want to watch lots of film and TV, even when you're not doing the job. A little bit of OCD, but not too much. One piece of advice is try and get into some sort of editing suite. Because the job that we do, we're providing information for post-production based on what the director wants. But if you've not been in an edit suite, because I got trained by a script supervisor, or one of the people that trained me, her husband was an editor. So she let me spend quite a bit of time with him. Then you can stop worrying about certain bits of continuity because you're already trying to edit it in your head. Doesn't always happen, but that is one of the things. There are lots of, I mean, there's the Admiral Rowland's week course, as I said. There's quite a few books. Read up, do the theory, and then try wherever possible. And we're still advocating for trying to get trainees and assistants on set, because it's a job you learn on set.
Yeah, so try and find someone that will basically give you a chance. Get some direct training in addition to maybe doing the course and also reading up.
Yeah, I mean, and it's proving more and more difficult because there's less people on set. So I don't know. Until I start my next job, I won't know how that scenario is going to work. But what I am saying to anybody that's asking me is to bring a bit more to the table. So they should do the Screen Skills Basic Awareness course, which is open to everybody. If they can train up in some sort of first aid, do that. So when the opportunity comes for you to be on set, you're coming with more than one skill base. Mm. Actually, I would say that for all departments now.
I think that's a good kind of lesson for life as well. Just keep acquiring knowledge and different kind of strands that can add like the string to your bow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So what is one of the biggest challenges you've faced in your career?
The job that you definitely wanted and you didn't get, somebody else got it. That's a disappointment, really, rather than a challenge. And I think, really, it's going to be COVID, because I'm going to have to fundamentally change how I do my job in order to fit with the new regime.
Wow. Well, you're the first person that I've said that, and it does sound like it's a logistical juggle going forward.
Yeah. But at least I know I've had, 30 years of fun so far.
So what do you love about what you do?
Well, God, it's the travel. Yeah, I've got friends for life. People I've worked with when I first started, we're still in communication. And also just the opportunities. So there was a smaller project for a friend of mine, Adam Smethurst, an actor, and he was doing 12th Night using all the same language as Shakespeare, but in a modern setting. Absolutely the best fun I've had that I can sort of run to, because I did do Shakespeare at school, but I wasn't very good at it. So to have this opportunity now to work on a project like that was amazing.
I think you just have fun wherever you go, Emma, I have to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to. Whatever happens. But, you know, it's just team. We're all a team.
Yeah.
So you sort of just keep doing as much as you can, you know, and it's going to be different every day. So you've got to come in with your game face. I can't say that I'm in a good mood every single day of a very long shoot, mm-hmm. but, you know, you try your best, really. And compared to some people in some countries, we're very, very lucky to be working in this industry.
So how do you fuel your creativity?
Jazz, funk and soul. So as many concerts in between, I'd probably set up, as soon as I knew I was finishing my last job pre-COVID, I'd already set up the Cheltenham Jazz Festival concert with my friends. Hotels were booked. There was a soul weekender happening near where I live. And we were going to see one of my favourite artists, Mario Biondi, who's an Italian soul singer, dancing and watching more films, ironically.
I don't think you sleep by all accounts of your descriptions of what.
Oh, I do. I do. Basically, you probably sleep for about a week as soon as you finish the shoot, or you keep yourself very busy because you're still in that sort of treadmill of shooting a schedule, or you book yourself a holiday as soon as possible.
All right. Well, speaking of loosening up of quarantine measures, you've got a job on the cards starting next week. Is that correct?
I'm in preparation next week. Yeah. Okay. From home, obviously.
So, and that's coming up for you and anything else on the horizon? I mean, it's great the industry is starting to open up the doors again.
It is. Well, you know, this will be the sort of first job that I'll go to in the new environment. So really, once that happens, and I'll be giving lots of feedback to my fellow script supervisors and other crew members, just to sort of say, you know, that this is what we're facing. I mean, I know every single production company will put in as many resources possible, and we'll do the best job we can.
Well, good luck with that. And I'm keen to hear how that goes.
Thank you.
So we're going to wrap up now. But before you go, something I ask everyone is two questions. A career or job in the creative industries you know little about and always been curious about, and that way I can potentially get someone in that role on and explore what they do. And also a woman that you would recommend that I get in touch with to interview on Greater Than 11%.
Thing for me, it's going to be gaming. I just don't know what all that is about. And it's, you know, it's got awards, it's got its own ceremonies, all that sort of stuff. And then animation. And I really, really love watching with my nieces and nephews, you know, animation films and stuff. But I don't really know the production, how that all works, etc., etc. So that would be that. And then a woman within the creative industry as well, probably be my sister, but she'll probably be working as well.
Okay, awesome.
She'll have a different point of view when we work together. Does she get her continuity right? Yes, of course she does.
She's an actress, right?
She is.
Oh, awesome. I would love to have her on. We haven't had an actress, actually, so that would be wonderful.
Well, I'll leave that as your little challenge to find out who it is. And she is in a series running at the moment.
Oh, that's exciting. Well, she features on your BAFTA speech, so I've got a pretty good idea. So.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Emma. I've so loved catching up with you and learning about this role, which is like so intense and it's so brilliant. And you obviously have so much fun doing it.
Thank you very much, Renee.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases.